evening. Welcome to the Solari Report. Today is Thursday, April 4th, 2019. This is Catherine Austin Fitz. I'm delighted you could join me this evening. Our theme tonight is Caveat Emptor. That's the name of an article that I published on February 21st. It's part of the 2018 annual wrap-up. The full title is Caveat Emptor, Why Investors Need to Do Due Diligence on U.S. Treasury and Related Securities. As I travel about and talk to investors and to subscribers, one of the things I'm discovering is that it really hasn't sunk in what FASB 56 means and what it means to us as for those of us who are citizens, of those of us who are impacted globally, because it's a global impact. It's in everybody's pension funds globally. This is going to impact credit broadly throughout the globe. And so it's important to understand. I would really encourage you to read the article Caveat Emptor. I wrote it with my attorney, Carolyn Betts, and it goes through the impact of 56 and what it means. It's a dense article, and that's because this is a highly legalistic subject, but it's extremely important. One of the excerpts that we publish in the commentary, which is up on the website, that'll take you to it. In this article, we explain, with reference to other materials available on the Solari Report site, that it is no longer prudent for the investor to rely solely upon primary and secondary security dealers, the U.S. rating agencies, and mandatory disclosure by issuers to accurately assess the risks and values of certain securities. While we encourage investors to do their own due diligence, we also recognize that FASB 56 eliminates any hope that an investor will be able to obtain sufficient information to accurately assess the credit and value of his or her holdings of U.S. Treasury and other securities whose values are affected by Statement 56, i.e. a meaningful percentage of U.S. public and private equity and debt securities. It also links to the briefing document we wrote on FASB 56 for those who want to dive in more deeply. The adoption of FASB 56 in October 2018 was the most important event in the U.S. in the last year. And you have to understand this, that Trump owns FASB 56, so does the House and Senate leadership, both Democrat and Republican. This was everybody. Everybody did this together. It was a unified action taken during the Kavanaugh hearings. My guess is the Kavanaugh hearings, frankly, were designed, and their most important goal was to get FASB 56 through unnoticed. Although, legitimately, there was a fight by the Democrats to stop the Republicans getting their person in. But the reality is FASB 56 was far bigger and more important. There are profound implications, not just to U.S. government and the U.S. securities market, but also to the use of mercenary armies and secret operations in the U.S. and globally. So this is really a fundamental change in the governance of the United States government and global government, as well as private corporations and the global economy. So again, I understand this is dense material, but you need to understand this. And you need to understand that it's the end of the American Constitution, democratic process, and markets if we allow it to stand. Now, what do I mean if we allow it to stand? Your pension fund, my pension fund, your Social Security, if you get it, my Social Security, our insurance companies, our bank deposits, it's our money which is financing this. And I assure you, if 5 to 10% of the American people stop financing it, or certainly started asking questions of their pension funds and banks, et cetera, it could absolutely change what is happening. For all we know, a significant portion of the money that is buying U.S. Treasuries is funding assets which are being transferred out the back door. I mean, it's absolutely possible with this in place that there is no government. There's simply the great Oz running a marketing shell, and the result is to the benefit of private investors. It's the ultimate in privatization. our pension funds or Social Security buys Treasury securities, the money buy assets, and the assets disappear out the back door. With FASB 56, there's no way to tell that that isn't happening. And frankly, with $21 trillion missing from the federal government, there's a lot to suggest that it has been happening. And I keep getting a variety of different questions about Trump as though Trump is trying to drain the swamp. I assure you, Trump did this. Trump owns FASB 56. There's no swamp draining. That's what you need to understand. This is the swamp completely overwhelming everything. Now, let's look what happened. Trump used Mattis, Kelly, and Tillerson to get huge increases in appropriations for the U.S. military. As soon as that was done, FASB 56 was passed, then Mattis was pushed out, and Kelly was pushed out and replaced by the guy from OMB who engineered FASB 56. Now, what does that mean? Mattis and Kelly were opposed to using mercenary armies. Now that they're out, we now have an infinite amount of money for an infinite amount of secret armies and unconstitutional action that can all be kept completely classified and secret. So whether it's engineering the California fires or engineering 1 million acres of floods in the Midwest, do you really think those events were natural? Or that the cleanup teams and related disaster capitalism are normal? I don't think so. I think for me, it's highly unlikely that many, if not most, of these events are natural. Now, we are financing this. If those events are unnatural, you and I are financing this. We have the power to not finance it. So it's our karma if we finance it. One way or another, I want you to connect the dots. I want you to see the connection between FASB 56 and the different things that are going on in the Trump administration and in the Congress, and how that translates into all of these covert operations, not just around the United States, but around the world. This is a global operation. Investors all around the world are financing this, and these covert operations and secret armies are operating globally. And you know, I come back to us. We're financing this, and if we keep doing it, it's our karma. Money and markets. I'm using total returns for the year, and this is of the Wednesday close. So today is April 4th, but I'm still in Switzerland, flying back tomorrow. I'm using the April 3rd close. U.S. dollar index now up 1.24% for the year. You can see on the fixed income the difference with the Fed backing off. The fear of inflation goes to fear of deflation. So they've backed off on interest rates. They've backed off on shrinking the bond position. And you still have QE programs going on around the world. So the public line is the Fed backing up has now prevented the chance of recession. That's not what I see. I see the smart money getting ready to weather a recession. And if we certainly don't get it this year, I don't see how we miss out on it the year after the presidential election. So you need to do the same. Be prepared for a recession or slower growth scenario. Even if there's no recession, if you look at the difference between slower growth, GDP growth anywhere from 0 to 2%, and the Chapwood Index, which is my favorite index of a basket of household goods. You can find it online. Just do a search for the Chapwood Index. What it'll show you is in the United States, the cost of goods rising for basic household goods is anywhere from 8 to 14.5%. So if your income is growing at 0 to 2% and your expenses are growing at 8 to 14.5% every year, we know where that leads. That's the slow burn, and the squeeze continues. The long Treasury ETF up 3% for the year, the intermediate up 2.04%, the bond aggregate up 2.58%. That's a big improvement now that the bond market is satisfied that the Fed's not going to push interest rates higher. Junk flying at 8.23%. The message is clearly risk on. We now have debt trading, mostly sovereign debt trading, around the globe at negative yields, topping $10 trillion. That's a real message of deflation. There's a push in many places for zero cash. Not surprising given the negative yields, of course. If they keep people from stockpiling cash in a negative yield environment, it's just another way to harvest them. I'm reminded of, I had a client in 2009 who, looking for safety, went to buy a sovereign Swiss bond and discovered that it was a negative yield. So she went to Kiva.org and made microloans instead. She figured, okay, I get zero interest, but I don't have a negative interest, and I'm confident they'll pay it back. It's kind of funny. Saudi Arabia's Aramco has just launched their first public securities offering. It's a $10 billion bond offering. I put the link to the prospectus, which is out of London, in News Trends and Stories and the Twitter feed. You can find it there. They're going to raise $10 billion of cash, and then they're at the same time they're buying from the Saudi Sovereign Wealth Fund a chemical company for between $60 and $70 billion. The wealth fund is then suddenly going to have significant money to reinvest. And the question is, I wonder where that money's going. Kind of secret. Given what's been going on with the Saudis, it makes you wonder. Equities market very strong so far for the year. The S&P up almost 15%. Home builders almost up 20%. The Lyft IPO went out this week. And, of course, Lyft still losing money. All the best stock performers are losing money. We're not making a whole lot of money. One of the things that was interesting about the Aramco prospectus is it turned out to be more profitable in 2018. Aramco turned out to be more profitable in 2018 than Apple, Exxon, and Amazon combined. Anyway, the Lyft IPO priced at the top of the range, then jumped up, then dropped significantly, and you've got heavy short sellers. And now it's trading about 3% below the IPO price. So the short sellers are trying to have a field day. Let's see if they win or not. VGK, the European ETF, up 12.82%. Lots of press saying that the European economy is slow. But things look fine to me since I've been here. I've been in the Netherlands. I've been in Denmark. I've been in Italy. And I've been in Switzerland. And things seem to be tootling along. Germany up 8.32%, and the developed markets minus North America up almost 12%. The large cap, China up 14.5%, small caps up 18.79%, and the emerging markets up 11.34%. The commodities index up 9.76%, gold up 60 basis points, so that's 0.6%, not even 1%. Silver down 2.5%, and oil flying up almost 50%. Britain and the United Kingdom are in the throes of working out Brexit. It's getting ugly. The Parliament took over for May. It's an unprecedented action. And May and the EU have worked out various deals, but Parliament won't agree to it. Part of the problem is if you look at the House of Commons, it represents a different profile than the referendum vote. Many people voted in at an earlier time, and they're far less pro-Brexit than, or they started off a lot less pro-Brexit than the general population. You also have some financial interests pushing to prevent Brexit and others on the other side. So it's a controversial decision. You don't have that kind of 80% for that you need to make big changes typically in politics. My prediction, again, is that there will be a Brexit. I continue to believe that the city and the offshore haven system, especially combined with things like FASB 56, the Anglo-American Alliance post the financial coup, wants to go completely dark. So they want to keep the offshore haven and the city out of the ECB and the Germans' watchful eye and regulation. I would, if you haven't watched the Spider's Web documentary on the British offshore haven system, I think you'll find it very interesting. So the question now is, the hard Brexit date got moved to April 12th. Will May and the EU and the Parliament, May is now negotiating with Jeremy Corbyn, the Labour leader. Will some package of this be able to come together for a deal, or will they take a hard Brexit? It's perfectly possible, but there are many different options of what can happen. And the longer it goes on, though, the more friction there is in the global economy and the more uncertainty is there in the financial markets. I was asked on Coast to Coast earlier this week whether or not Trump would really shut down the border, Mexican border. I said, not a chance. And sure enough, today we see lots of coverage about the U.S. leaders explaining to, or business leaders explaining to Trump why that's not going to happen. I have big questions about what's really going on in the border. We have record detain and release, more and more people coming across the border. And the question is this really pressure from people trying to get away from the cartels or the economic problems in Mexico, or is something else going on? But we have a record number of detain and release. If you look at all the things the administration could have done in terms of tightening up border control, I don't think they're doing what they can do administratively. So I have questions about what the sincerity of this is. And my biggest concern on the wall is, you know, is the wall to keep people out or is it to keep people in? Remember, you know, given our debt problems, more immigration helps with the debt. So I guess at this point I question the sincerity of what the administration is saying and what it's really doing. There's a big disconnect. But there's no doubt about it. The number of people who coming across the border are significant. The Mueller report has come out, and there's obviously lots of feedback and discussion as everybody waits for a redacted version. All we have is Barr's summary report. It's interesting. If you look at what happened, two things went on. One is that Mueller really did target the swamp critters around Trump, the three main one being Manafort, Stone, and Cohen, and literally put them in a position to not behave like swamp critters in a Trump administration. And oddly enough, Mueller may have done made a significant contribution to protecting a Trump administration from some of their the players who historically had the sort of dirtiest records in terms of sort of taking advantage of political power to do personal deals. Then, of course, we had the Russian hoax, which the Democrats joined in on, but it wouldn't surprise me given the sort of closeness of Trump and his operation to the Russian mafia if it didn't probably put a kibosh on the deals. Here's the reality. When you've never worked in government, you don't know why and how to be careful. And there was no doubt that the Trump group just wasn't prepared for the care they needed to take. I just finished reading Vicki Ward's book, Kushner, Inc., and you can see the swamp is alive and well between Kushner and his relationship with Netanyahu. We all better pray that Netanyahu loses his election in Israel this year, but the majority of Israelis want him out, but there's such a plethora of candidates and parties that split the vote. He could get back despite that and despite the various threats to indict him. So there's no doubt, I'll put a review of Kushner Inc. up later, but there's no doubt that the Jared Kushner sort of conduct is, you know, the swamp is alive and well. What can I say? There's a reason why we get things like the Russian hoax or Monica Lewinsky. The reality is you have to go at somebody on something that's fake. If you go at them on something that's real, it could boomerang and hit just about everybody else. That's the problem in a swamp, is sort of everybody's dirty and everybody's connected. So I think that was one of the reasons for the Russian hoax. Another reason is, you know, these kinds of tactics, if you look at the effort to frame me, it was pretty Mickey Mouse. And yet those Mickey Mouse things always worked 10 or 20 years ago. But the world is getting smarter. And of course, on this one, you had a lot of people looking and digging and figuring it out. And the hoax has really, I think, backfired. It's had a tremendous impact on sort of the credibility of the FBI and Department of Justice. Trump's, you know, the job of getting Trump has now been turned over to the Southern District with a focus on his tax returns and business dealings. And in fact, we see Congress, who's now filing subpoenas to get both the Mueller report and Trump's tax return. And if anything is likely to push Trump to run again, it's the need to sort of stay on top of all this stuff. And it's much easier to do that from the White House than, among other things, as a sitting president, he can't be indicted. One of the shocking things, I'm sure, for the new Attorney General Barr is that we have leaks immediately to the New York Times accusing Barr of sugarcoating his report on the Mueller report. It's leaks from people who worked on the Mueller investigation, and they're leaking to the Times that that Barr's report really did make things look much better than it was. I think Barr was assuming that there was enough internal discipline in the profession at the Department of Justice and the special investigative team to not do things like that. That's a, you know, 20 years ago, that was a very shocking thing to do. But it shows you just how, I don't know, the level of agite in Washington is really at a galactic level. And it shows you the deterioration in those standards. The Bushies were used to being able to lie a lot and get away with it because of those standards, and now they can't. You see this kind of pushback dynamic, and it's very interesting. Let me give you a couple of different examples, but it shows you how tricky and treacherous the environment is and how many really smart people are beginning to push back. There was a federal court judge in California who issued a decision on the California magazine ban, saying it violated the Second Amendment. And I'll tell you, this decision is something beautiful. I posted it in News Trends and Stories and tweeted it out as well. It's amazing. You just want to stand up and cheer when you read the decision. Several subscribers sent me links, and I really appreciate it. But talk about a judge who knows the real deal and knows what's going on and can write a compelling decision to just, just say the facts and bust through all the sort of mind-controlled trance on the gun issue. It really is a thing of beauty. Then I also posted a letter written by a former Bain associate who used to work at Bain when Romney was there on vaccine mandates. It's a woman who's a mother. Her children were vaccine injured. She's written a book on vaccines. And she wrote a letter to Romney in anticipation of testimony this week in the Senate saying, if you try and mandate vaccines, it will backfire. And the quality and intelligence of this letter is overwhelming. And what you realize is, you know, 10 or 20 years ago, people of that professional experience just didn't presume that the system was as corrupt as it is. But now they do, and now they're punching back, and they're punching back publicly and openly, and they're angry in a very effective way. And you read this and you think, you know, whew, here it comes. It's a good sign. This is the kind of pushback we need. As I said, I finished the book Kushner, Inc. It's written by Vicky Ward, who does a lot of writing, among other things, a British investigative reporter, writes for Vanity Fair. And boy, she's dug out a lot, and she's nailed a lot. And it's very rare, only 2 years into a administration, that you would have somebody write this much, dig out this much. But one of the things that's clear is she got a lot of people to talk to her. And as I said, it's a little bit like the leaks out of the Mueller investigative team. You know, people are not sitting on this stuff anymore. they're it's cycling back around. Another very interesting example is Gavin De Becker published, I'm sure with Bezos's permission, a description of the finding of their investigation on behalf of Bezos, that the Saudis had compromised Bezos's the hacking of his telephone and compromised his security. This is very interesting because if you look at the various events swirling around Bezos and his interests as they relate to the Trump administration, you wonder what are the connections between these different events. You have the Saudi journalist murder on October 2nd, which just happens again to be right before the FASB 56 sneaks through. So that certainly keeps the Washington Post busy in the middle of the Kavanaugh and FASB 56. We have, and of course, the Washington Post owned by Bezos. Then we have the hacking of Bezos' phone and dishing out the dirt, contributing to his divorce. It wouldn't surprise me if entrainment was involved. And then a nasty contract battle over the JEDI contract at the Department of Defense, which really had been expected to be won by Amazon. And if you look at sort of the involvement of the Saudis and their closeness back again around to Jared Kushner, you wonder how these different issues connect. For Bezos' security chief to come out and say in the middle of all of this, oh, it was the Saudis that hacked Bezos' phone, shows you the kind of pushback that would never happen 10 years ago. So that pot is getting stirred. So let's just pray for the truth to be revealed. And finally, another thing disappearing is sort of indemnity. People who think they can act above the law with impunity are learning now that the financial coup is over, they can't. With that in mind, I also put up at News Trends and Stories and then tweeted out a video that Ed Rollins' PAC put out. That Ed Rollins and his partner are pushing for Trump in 2020. They put out a video called Creepy Joe on Biden, which is incredible. It uses all the different videos of Biden inappropriately touching women and children, but it's very tough stuff. And it just says one message that we're all going to experience, and that is accountability, both fair and unfair, reasonable and unreasonable, is going to keep increasing, and it's going to make for a much meaner environment, particularly as the debt squeeze continues. Last but not least, there is a future. Mike Pence announcing the NASA is going back to the moon by 2024, and the NASA administrator coming out and saying, ah, we're working on a plan. Now that the Chinese are on the far side of the moon, NASA has decided it's time for the Americans to get back. Our interview today is with Nina Hein, who is the author of our Food for the Soul column. It's a bi-monthly column on films and art for the Solari Report. I love it. For 2 years, she was anonymous as, quote-unquote, your culture scout, and now she's come out of the closet, and it's a real pleasure for me to introduce her to you. Nina came to Europe, and we met to go to Milan and tour the exhibits for Leonardo da Vinci, and then up to the Amsterdam to tour the Rembrandt's exhibit. It's the 350th anniversary of Rembrandt's death and the 500th anniversary of Leonardo da Vinci. And that's, to me, that's a big deal because you're, particularly da Vinci, is such a great story of how just a few people can make such an extraordinary difference to pulling us out of a dark age. Anyway, Nina is an extraordinary, one of the most extraordinary people I've ever known. She has deep experience in the movie industry. I describe it in our commentary. And but her passion for museums and for art, but her knowledge, she was head of global publicity for one of the largest movie studios in America for many years and did global publicity everywhere. She's She's just traveled extensively, and as a result, she has tremendous and very deep understanding of the economics of movie, entertainment, culture, and brings all of that to the Food for the Soul column. If you haven't read it, it's absolutely fantastic. And if you go to Soleri homepage, down on the right, you'll see the little Food for the Soul logo. And of course, it comes up in What's New and in commentaries as well when it publishes. She's got a great one on sort of introducing our activities this year for Leonardo da Vinci. We're calling it the Year of Da Vinci. Anyway, Nina's our hero. I put her in a boat. We decided we would do one of our interviews, and it was supposed to be a really sunny, beautiful day in Amsterdam, and instead it was gray and freezing, so I made her get in a boat, and we had a great talk. She froze her head off. Anyway, Nina Hein, your culture scout, the columnist Food for the Soul. Check it out. In Let's Go to the Movies, I recommended a short documentary on Dutch history called When the Dutch Ruled the World. It's quite well done and sort of fun to watch, but the reason I wanted you to see it is that it is worth revisiting a time when corporations basically had charters from government to wage war, conquer, occupy territory, and tax. It's important to understand that these historical precedents existed. They worked, they happened, and in their time they were successful. And as we tear up the Treaty of Westphalia and take our finances secret, it looks very much to me like the investment community has decided they wanted to go back to some of the older models and try and do them again. So I think just understanding the historical precedent really helps to understand the conversation about piratization and privatization. The Dutch East India Company was, in its day in the early 1600s, was highly profitable for investors. It had 50,000 employees, an army of 30,000 men, and a fleet of 200 ships. According to one report called The Nutmeg Wars, it gave its shareholders an annual dividend of 40% on their return. In a world of low yield, it's, you know, for some investors, it's a way to go. One of the things that was interesting about what the Dutch did, they took a lot of their profits that they made on either global conquest or the spice trade, and reinvested them in land reclamation. If you look at Dutch engineering, it's considered one of the great infrastructure stories of the world. And I also put up links to two sort of short, they're kind of graphical PowerPoint. I wouldn't quite call them documentaries, but they show you how the Dutch did it and what they did. And it's one of the reasons. Dutch East India Company is one of the reasons that the Netherlands to this day is one of the great centers of global investment. The land reclamation is one of the reasons they're one of the top food exporters of the world. Ask Catherine. FYI, Catherine, some good news. It's so refreshing to have a judge faithfully apply the law with a well-reasoned, rational, scholarly analysis. And sure enough, this is one of the great subscribers who sent in this amazing decision on the finding the California magazine ban violating the Second Amendment. Anyway, I posted and tweeted it out, and reading it is deeply gratifying. I recommend it to you. Ignorance is bliss or power. I'm an aging contractor. My plan was to purchase rentals to offset my ability to physically earn money. With over 30 years in the business, I think the time is now. I'm not afraid of purchasing the multifamily units. I'm afraid knowing what's in the pipeline for tomorrow. At least I think I know. The issue megacities help me. I will not bet the farm on it, but I have funds put aside. Do you think housing crash market can crash again? So keep funds ready for a better opportunity. Do you think interest rates will go high to offset the discount price of another housing crash? I love your approach to life. So you need to be prepared for things to go I strongly recommend scenarios. There's no way to predict the future. Here's the reality. I'll talk a lot more about this in the equity overview, but the absolute pressure is one of inflation in the value of real assets. Now, there are offsetting trends that can really deflate the housing market, and one of them is automation and how it's going to squeeze people's income. And so you need to make sure if you're buying and investing in multifamily units, you're in an area that's one not targeted for reengineering by oligarchs, so you get the kind of things that are happening in California. But two, you need to make sure that you have really enduring demand. It's great if you could be near a state university, et cetera. I don't know what your location is. So as you know, all real estate is local. But there's no doubt that solid, well-built, income-producing real estate should be able to take advantage of the inflationary trends. But again, you have to be prepared to live through the ups and downs. My other concern on real estate is I think there is going to be a real push to regulate and manipulate, particularly using things like the Green New Deal, things like that. So we're going to be doing an interview in a month or two with Patrick Wood on technocracy, and I strongly recommend that you familiarize yourself with Agenda 2030 and you listen to that interview on technocracy. So again, it's local. You want to be in a jurisdiction where you are pretty confident in the local leadership. Next question, have you seen this? And it's one of the new articles about the $21 trillion and the Pentagon audit. Yes, I've seen it. It's like the second Taibbi piece. I think there's a lot of saltwater taffy leading you no place. We need to be asking fundamental questions about the securities market and connecting the dots to the fact that we're financing all of this. So it's not one that I've posted. Misfits, have you heard Brent Johnson's dollar milkshake theory? Sounds an awful lot like your dollar short squeeze theory. Could you elaborate the similarities in your next market commentary? I listened to the first half of his interview on Real Vision TV. I hadn't heard it before you asked the question. Yes, it's very similar to my dollar bear trap theory. He does a good job of describing what the bear trap is, and it's part of why I think the dollar is dangerous and dominant for now. And he's also right that global QE can work to the U.S. Advantage if we are the ones attracting in most of that liquidity that's created by the QE. I think that is true. I'm not as enthusiastic as him. If you look at the latest figures, it looks like the Trump tax changes has only brought back about $600 or $700 billion, not the full $4 billion that they were hoping for. He doesn't mention how the China rebalancing fits in, and that's putting a lot more pressure and squeeze on the U.S. than, if you integrate it in. The other thing is there's tremendous friction in the global economy, more centralization and major environmental issues. And again, he doesn't mention any of that. It's sort of a strictly financial analysis. But I agree with his argument for real assets. I think there's reasonably good chance of continued strong inflation in real assets. The one thing I would say, I'm not a believer in predicting the future. And what he's describing is one scenario, but again, given the uncertainty and the change in sort of the global model, both of governance and finance, I think many different scenarios are possible. But I think it's important to be prepared to navigate multiple scenarios. But clearly the dollar bear trap, or what he calls the milkshake, is one very possible scenario. And I think he does a good job of making the case about why the dollar is a lot stronger than most people expect, or many people expect. There's a significant sort of theory that the dollar's about to collapse. And it certainly hasn't. It's strong. It's up for the year. Dear CAF and team, in case this is of importance to you, I regularly get Roots Action notices, and there have been a lot lately from various sites. And here's the notice. It was about the NATO Secretary's speech in Congress this week. It's very interesting to note that speech. It's very rare that a non-head of state is invited to address Congress. And I think one of the reasons that happened is there's real concern that there is a deterioration of leadership in the Western world, and that deterioration is making the deterioration of the Western world accelerate and far worse than it has to be. And this was a bipartisan effort by McConnell and Pelosi to sort of shore up the transatlantic cooperation and partnership. And of course, many of the heads of state right now in the EU would not be anywhere near as well received. So I think that NATO secretary, who's a Norwegian, former Norwegian prime minister, has less baggage than many others. If you don't know what NATO is or understand NATO, it's worth spending some time. I would also make sure you take a look at Operation Gladio, which was the European false flags financed by NATO from World War II forward. I think it's important to understand Operation Gladio. I posted a comment on the subscriber input in response to somebody's question about this, and I just want to read it to you because it was quite chilling when I was in Denmark. And this is what I posted today. Quote, "When I was in Denmark, a member of the audience snapped at a lecturer who mentioned NATO. He snapped that Denmark had passed a law making it a crime to criticize NATO with a maximum penalty of 12 years in prison. The member of the audience sounded afraid for his liabilities, for his own liabilities if he happened to be in a room with someone else who said something negative. I tried to find confirmation of such a law actually being passed and adopted. I could only find an article about the proposal, so I'm not sure if it was adopted, but the experience was more than creepy." Then somebody sent in a notice about the measles outbreak in Rockland County inspiring a state of emergency with pretty frightening controls. The idea being kids who haven't been vaccinated are not allowed in public facilities, parks, etc. Interestingly enough, talking about smart pushback, I posted another article from someone who decided to give chapter and verse on what the facts are about measles and the spread of measles. Of course, makes the whole thing ridiculous. And the question is this just a prototype to try and get far more central control, or is this part of the desire to mandate vaccines? Either one is not good, and this is something that needs tremendous pushback. I remember I was part of the pushback on the swine flu vaccine. But, you know, they're going to double down here. And the question is it really about trying to, to get people vaccinated for covert reasons? Or is this about just creating a, you know, an even tighter control grid? Whatever the agenda is, it's not good and it's not legitimate. So, this is one of those situations where the secrecy is very evil and it's a place to push back. No one would expect the average car owner to fix their vehicle in the event of an unexpected mechanical failure, but certainly one would expect the crew of a new and modern cruise ship to be able to restart their engines. Apparently not. The engines of the Norwegian cruise ship, the Viking Sky, could only be restarted after a specialty maintenance crew was brought on board by helicopter. This after the ship had drifted dangerously close to shore. What is it about this technology that makes it so complex? And is it the complexity of the systems and end in themselves rather than a focus on the safe operation of the vessel by the onboard crew? The recent Boeing mishaps may represent a similar phenomena. What is going on? This is a very important question, and it's a very good and important insight. There's a lot of different things happening together, but let's look at the combination. One is you have significantly more complexity in machinery and equipment, and everything is being designed. In fact, one of the things the farmers all complain about is that the new farm equipment is being made so literally you can't fix it yourself. Part is done with complexity, but other parts are done with warranty or the way it's done to make it almost impossible. And I've watched for years now as the farmers grapple with trying to find workarounds so they can do it by themselves. And part of it is not just a matter of cost. They don't have time to take it in and have somebody else do it. They need to be there in the field and just fix it themselves. So complexity and engineered complexity for financial control and greater financial profits is one of them. Central control is another. The way you centrally control is you get everybody totally specialized. And of course, then you end up with people not knowing how to, in these cases, fix or deal with this situation. Corporate profits. You have smart machines and dumbed down people. They're trying to get the machines to do everything smart and use people who are the least qualified, least experienced, and continue to turn them over so they don't have power. They're easy to control. What do you get? You get messes like this. Again, corporate profits. You have insufficient training and experience. I posted a great article on some of the naval accidents if it could be covert warfare, but some of the naval incidents is the U.S. Navy in the South China Sea. And clearly, that's part of the problem, whether it's caused the incident or it's the response to the incident. What you see in the Boeing situation is pretty frightening, and it's going to be very bad for Boeing's brand, what it appears to be deservedly so. But again, insufficient training and experience, or a desire to save money and cut corners. Finally, and I think one of the worst problems, is you have optimization for politics and not performance. And so both in the corporations and government, and many of these corporations have big government contracts and government subsidy, what you're getting is you're getting people who are getting promoted because they're politically influential or connected, not because of their performance. And, you know, it's interesting, the U.S. planes are starting to get better, but I remember when I started to do a lot of travel by plane, it was embarrassing to fly Qantas or Swiss Air or KLM compared to U.S. planes and trains, because you felt like the U.S. planes and trains were just part of a financial scam pump and dump. Nobody really cared about, you know, their business was not flying customers around. Their business was pumping and dumping stocks. Whereas the European and in my experience, the Chinese airlines, their real business was flying airlines. Anyway, this all combines up to tremendous hidden risks. And I think it's going to get much worse before it gets better. And we all need to prepare for it. So if you're in an area where the infrastructure is bad, you need to be prepared to deal with that. Because this can create enormous shadow risk. I published a video this week in News Trends and Stories that someone in a Christian ministry down in L.A. had done on the Mississippi River Basin and the failure to invest in the management of the waterways and the danger of flooding and what it could do. It could literally shut down the U.S. economy if you don't properly care for the transportation routes on the Mississippi and the related waterways that go into the New Orleans port. So I discussed this a little bit more in my review of Michael Lewis's book, The Fifth Risk. What he's talking about is a real deterioration in the civilian infrastructure of the United States, but we're seeing it in other parts of the world. So I had a tea this afternoon with a wonderful Swiss subscriber. And one of the things they discussed is a referendum coming up where if the Swiss agree to the EU terms, they're going to have to privatize their transportation system. Well, if you look at the transportation system in Switzerland, it's absolutely superb. I can get just about anywhere from anywhere and do it very quickly and logically and comfortably and economically between the tram and train systems, and the bus systems. It's fantastic. It's just absolutely fantastic. It's just a dream to get around Switzerland and travel around Switzerland. And it's so embarrassing when you get around Switzerland and you come back to the United States and try and take the train. It's funny, I just met in Geneva with Alistair Thompson, who had come back from Shanghai. The first thing he said to me was, "Oh, now I understand why it's so important I read Megacities. I need to know about this." But the second thing he said was, you know, after being on the Chinese high-speed trains, you know, it's just miraculous and amazing, you know, what they've managed to do. And so if you're on the Chinese high-speed trains or the Swiss trains and you come back to America, it's just, you just want to curl up in a ball and die of shame. Hi, Catherine. Are you familiar with Michael Hudson's work and his conclusions? I wonder what Thomas Meyer thinks about Hudson's work and how it might fit in with Steiner. And then she describes Michael Hudson. I've found Hudson to be quite competent. I have not watched a lot of his work, but I've always liked what I've seen. I think he's solid and sincere from what I know of him. Anyway, so yeah. One of the things I've thought about doing was getting him on the Solari Report. He's on a possibility list. Hi, Catherine. I'm a subscriber. I live in a Toronto area. And then he describes a theory he has on an alternative view for the analysis of the Vitruvian Man. And he's interested in Walter Bosley reviewing his angle. So I've sent your information and contact information to Walter Bosley, and he'll be free to follow up. Hi, can you ask Catherine what is that book she once recommended that talks about how dirty money is laundered through franchises? I want to read it. Thanks. It's Black Money by Michael Thomas. Strongly recommended to. It was recommended to me by the proprietor Winslow, the man who made Promise Software. Okay, that is it for this week. Next week, April 11th, we have the Glyphosate Wars with Sophia Smallstorm. Then the following week, we start the first quarter wrap-up, the Equity Overview and Rambus Chartology. Normally, we start with news, trends, and stories, but Joseph wanted to record late, so we'll be publishing that in the following 2 weeks of April. So, until next week, when I'm going to talk to you from Hickory Valley, Tennessee. I'll be flying there tomorrow a.m. out of Zurich. Please remember, don't worry about whether or not there is a conspiracy. If you're not in a conspiracy, you need to start one. Ladies and gentlemen, good night and good luck.